they'd have a 10-person family living in,
that area. So they could bring their families with them.
Right, exactly. And that way, they wouldn't have to go back and check on their families. They grew their own food. We got them started in agriculture products or projects, plants of various kinds. And then we got them, and believe it or not, there was not much utilization of the wealth of seafood on that shelf right off Vietnam. It's one of the richest in the world. And we got some small boats equipped so that they could fish. And today,
the Vietnamese had a lot of fish.
They did eat a lot of fish, but the Navy was, they had to go buy it elsewhere.
So
they started going out and doing their own fishing, and at a much reduced rate were able to supply seafood to the people on the base. So
Any of the other armed services do anything like that?
Yeah, the Marines did probably a similar effort. They had it pretty much in one area. They had a big, huge pig farm, and then they were trying to grow agricultural, plant products, crops, and they also had a big pool that was sewage from the pig pens drained into, and they had ducks on that pool, and they had a variety of fish that could survive on the excrement from the pigs. It was one of the greatest ecological experiments you've ever seen.
Carp. Catfish.
Right. But the big effort, the Vietnamese Armed Forces finally picked up a lot of shelter building and this sort of thing, and the Army did something like that too, but I think that Admiral Zumwalt's was a more comprehensive effort and was a little more innovative in this idea of trying to get them self-sustaining in their own program. Mm-hmm. And there's one other thing that he did. I think General Abrams put this boat in his head. General Abrams had seen a ferro cement boat in the Philippines one day. And so Admiral Zumwalt started looking around, and he found an Army first lieutenant who had architectural engineering background of some sort that was playing around with making some domes of ferro cement, which is a fancy name for four or five layers of chicken wire with a real thin.
My son was involved building a cement boat over in Amsterdam. He's still involved.
Okay.
Boat has been launched.
Well, and so we got the Vietnamese shipyard there, Navy shipyard, interested in making ferro cement boats. The first thing they did was made a carbon copy of one of their wooden junks that they were using. And it was really kind of funny because they made a real carbon copy of it. Now, the way you build a junk is you take one big central keel piece about that wide and about that thick. It goes the whole length, and that's the main member, and all the ribs come up from that and so forth. Mm-hmm. So they built to that same size. They built a form and poured concrete and made a keel that was that big, and then they brought the chicken wire up from the keel, and it was ferro cement like any other ferro cement, with the exception of that huge keel. Yeah. So it had about 1 foot less freeboard than most junks do. It was only about that much above the water.
Yeah, I was surprised it didn't go down altogether.
Well, it worked okay. And then the next thing they did is they built a ferro cement model of one of these aluminum 50-foot PCS. Mm-hmm. And then they put their own, I think it was wooden superstructure on the thing. And then after that, they sat down in their shipyard and they designed their own, a thing they called a coastal raider, which eventually would replace all their junks. The wooden junks have a life of about 5 years.
So?
The sea worms get to them, and apparently no matter what kind of anti-fouling paint you use, at the end of 5 years, you have rotten wood.
That's the waters there that kill
that. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So the beauty of ferro cement is it doesn't require the artificer who whittled away this nice keel. It's in the long run, believe it or not, cheaper. It's a fairly it's made of fairly easily gotten materials. It does require a little bit of skill to only in. You got to practice a couple of times before you get a good one. It's easily repairable, and it would get better with age instead of deteriorating with age. So they started building these things, and I guess they may have something like 100 of these coastal raiders right now. They got very interested in turning them out in their ship.
Well, they'll stand up to the vibration of a
yes, sir.
Of an engine.
We did get some cracks would propagate for a while, but that was no problem because it's very easy to repair. You just put
spackle them.
That's right. That's right.
So that's what I would have thought would have been a real problem would be the vibration would kind of crack it up.
It was the only problem, but it turned out not to be a significant problem. As a matter of fact, they built that PCF in 1969 and last year, 73, in my present job, I had to make a tour of some of my things going on in the Pacific, and I had to be in Subic Bay, and I had to be in Yokosuka, so on the way, I stopped off and spent a day's leave with Admiral Chan in Vietnam. And we drove down to one of the little bases that's about 20 miles south of Saigon and had dinner down there. And then we boarded that ferro cement PCF and drove it back up to Saigon. It's in good shape, working well. Yeah.
Oh.
That's 4 years.
My son always assured me that there was something in those cement boats, and I always sneered at him when he said so. Maybe he was right.
Well, there were just lots of advantages, and it's hard to come up with a disadvantage.
Well, this is the one I'm talking about, is half a dozen kids just put together themselves. I guess they're... The only thing they needed a real skilled help on was rigging, for one thing.
That's right.
Stepping the mast is quite a problem. It is a sailboat, not a schooner, I guess.
But I got pictures of all these things I've talked about. That's why I was ask you if you're interested in looking at the slides.
Maybe if we can get an illustrated book, we can put some of those pictures in the book.
I just try and give you an idea. But a great interest in the families. He was also interested always in trying to see if there wasn't a way to employ the families. And of course, that did happen at these bases. Some of the parents would be school teachers and they'd run their own schools at these bases.
Where was his family while he was in Vietnam?
In Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines, which he saw about once a month. He'd go over there for a weekend about once a month. Mm-hmm. This was feasible for anybody who was captain or above whose tour was going to be an extended tour.
How long supposed to be.
I suspect that that was ostensibly a two-year tour that he went on, which would have meant that they probably should have tried to get him out around September.
So
he went in May.
Yeah. So it was, so he didn't curtail it all that much.
I'm just guessing that that would have been a normal time delay. It would be about 2 years. And it was something around the 15th of May if I left the country.
Who was in the Philippines? The two girls? Wife and the two girls?
Yeah. That's exactly right. Occasionally, Jimmy the Marine, who was not a Marine then, he was still in North Carolina, he came over for one summer. And I don't know what the rank was, but he was there for a while.
Large fellow.
Yeah, I see.
And arms like that.
All those guys
Mickey
are
Mantle.
Fighters, just and his dad was too. Gosh, they're just really real persevering, aggressive people. And I, when I say aggressive, I don't mean it in the unpleasant sense. But this, I know you wanted to get off Vietnam, but I think all that is important, all that concern for the welfare of the Vietnamese families. But he felt that was going to make a better fighting man. If the guy
I know
was
so little about the military and what the job of a high-ranking officer is. How does a guy like that spend his day? You know, what do you devote your time to? How much time do you spend on what? How much are you in the office and how much are you out in the field?
Which job? In Vietnam, say? Generally, he would be in the field anywhere between 2 hours to a whole day.
He was out of the office a lot.
He was out of the office probably between a third and a half of the time.
He was. Just inspecting and visiting and watching and looking and.
What can he do to help? You know, what more resources do you need?
That implies he is a man who is quite willing to delegate routine to other. People who are working for him.
Oh yeah, and in some areas that he sees going well, a complete delegation. He hardly ever would bother you if you had something really on track. You just tell him periodically. Mm-hmm. He set up and managed for the information. That Admiral Tidd, who came over eventually as his chief of staff, set up management information. System so that every noon at I think it was 12 o'clock every day we always met and he gave a presentation on what the key problem was at the moment, how we were going, plus also an update on the chigs and pigs and chickens program.
Yeah. It was a daily staff meeting.
Yes, sir. Was called a management information meeting, and it was that. You would find out what was not going well and why not and what we needed to do. Do we need to move some resources around in the country? Do we need to go get some more resources from somewhere else? Do we need to go teach some people to do something they weren't doing before in this kind of
thing? Well, did you get 3 stars when you took this job?
I took the job. They upgraded it to a 3-star job and authorized him to wear 3 stars when he left the country. And so he arrived over there wearing 3-star.
It had not yet gone through.
Theoretically, see.
The senator or whatever else to go.
Yeah,
through.
It had. But theoretically, you are appointed a 3-star rank only to fill a 3-star job. They upgraded that job, but they authorize, this is common, they authorize a person as soon as they leave the continental U.S. On the way to that job, so you will come, so you arrive wearing the uniform. This is true of 4-star admirals, too.
You never just get appointed abstractly to 3 or 4-star rank. I mean, you're always in connection with a job.
Right.
How about your two stars? Does that come with a job too, or that you just make flag officer?
You make flag officer, and then they decide what flag job they're going to put you in.
But above that, it's always goes with
appointment
the job.
Appointment for the job, right. To the point that up until recently, I think we've changed it a little bit. If you were going from one 3-star job to another 3-star job, but you had a period in between where you were not attached, you'd have to revert
star?
To 2 stars. But I think we've changed that over the last couple of years. That's one of the things we've done.
So that's why you got to retire after CNO, huh?
Well, yeah, you know, or take another 4-star job, yeah, which
there are.
But I guess maybe we've hit Vietnam pretty hard. But
this is a 9-month project and a 150,000-word book, and so I don't suppose I'm getting too much information in my first week. Working on it, no. Everything's to the good. The only burden all of this is on is the girl who has to type it up. Since that is partly going to be one of his daughters-in-law.
Oh, really?
He's enlisted Lisa for part of that job.
Better watch my language.
No. Sure, she's heard all the words.
Well, of course, I hope she take some of this extraneous editorial comment.
No, we told her to put them in. Don't delete any expletives.
Oh, really? I mean, what we're saying right now, is she going to do all that too?
It's easier, actually, to do it all and to start editing, I think.
Okay.
It's easier for me to edit than for her to edit.
Okay. Hi, Lisa.
Right. Turn out to be somebody else who does it. All right, Mrs. Councilman, let's cover all of the bases. Okay. So then he got the job in Washington and sent for you one of the right first thing, or one of the first things.
Well, he, I was just a minor member. He put together a group of people that he was going to have on his own personal staff, which is now affectionately, quote unquote, termed the mini staff.
Why is it called that?
A small little staff. But he started putting together staff while it was still in Vietnam. Admiral Tidd, who was his chief of staff out there, came back and set up an organization designed to keep track of all the decisions that are made and make sure that they get implemented. And he got another briefing room set up that was called the NADAC, which stands for, I'll never remember, it doesn't matter, but his purpose was to keep track of all of the ideas and all of the decisions and make sure that, in fact, nothing fell through the cracks and everything got farmed out to an appropriate office, and that they checked to make sure that office was doing something.
He's a management specialist, I thought.
Right. The reason for this is that in talking to the previous CNOs, which he did as soon as he got into the city, he called on them all. The advice he got... Oh, yeah. I'm almost certain he did. The advice he got from many of them was, at the end of 4 years, you realize that there are a lot of things that you thought you did, that the bureaucracy just never got around to, and other things that you wish you had done that somehow or other the word never got out, this kind of thing. And so he thought that he would try to put up a, as you call it, a management specialist to try to see that not too many things fell through the cracks that he wanted to do. And so Admiral Tidd had that. Later, Admiral Tidd got that job. He was a captain. There was a person who had been the general counsel to Mr. Nitze, and Admiral Zumwalt was Mr. Nitze's executive assistant, Navy captain, lawyer, name was H.B. Robertson, Robbie, and he came in as his special counsel as when he became CNO. But this was all arranged while he was still in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. There was a commander who was a public affairs officer in Vietnam when he first got out there, that later went to some one of the forced colleges somewhere. And he got him lined up to be, that's Jack Davy, to be his personal
press guy.
Yeah. There was another one of the officers, in fact, the guy that that ran that giant slingshot operation for him, that he brought back to be his speechwriter. And the person that turned out to be his executive assistant was a person who had been executive assistant to Admiral Clary as vice chief naval operations, and he highly recommended him because, among other things, he was a flyer, and it would be good to have a flyer in the office since he was a destroyer. And we've done that kind of throughout the Navy. If you have a surface person in charge, then the deputy is usually an aviator, and maybe the guy's executive assistant is something of a different warfare specialty than the boss and so forth. So,
you qualify, you're the submarine fellow in this group?
Yeah, I was the original submarine guy, right. Captain Shepard, who's now an admiral, Captain Shepard had worked for Admiral Zumwalt in Op 96, which was the old systems analysis division, so he knew him very well, and then when Admiral Clary suggested that he was a good executive assistant, he was very happy to have him come over. And then I came along as kind of a special assistant, and I was going to be the point of contact with the people that were still
active. That's,
I can't tell you. Not as big as some of the other services, but it's fairly large, probably involving maybe 30 or 40 admirals.
That's enough admirals for one day.
And
proportionately,
proportionately down below that, yeah, down to the lieutenant commander level.
Not many junior officers.
Not too many. Only in the communications watch.
I've gone through the whole file of Z-grams, and I've also looked at all the markings on all the clearances by OOD and OOF and OO, whoever all of those people are.
Well, I was OOG, and I was OOG. And I usually coordinated the each thing before it got out. Now, we had to get the public affairs guy, who was OOD, I think, and we had to get the legal guy, who was OOF, which was Admiral Robertson, then Captain Robertson. And then Admiral Bagley was set up early on to be what he called PERS P, which was a new assistant chief of naval personnel that had never been there before, for people.
Yeah, I've written
And that was set up with one of the later Z-grams. But from then on, once he got into that position, then we always coordinated them with him, too. And this is after all the other staffing. You know, the normal staff would prepare something at his direction, then before it finally went out, this mini staff did some more rework on something. The most controversial of the Z-grams is Z-57.
Yeah.
And
it's the abrasive demeaning regulation.
I gave him a paper on that not very long ago on the amount of staffing that was done on that before it went out. I don't know whether you have a copy of it or not, but he has. And it's something you might want to look at because, as a matter of fact, there's a file over there that he has access to on the background of putting that together and what it looked like in various stages.
Yeah, it might be a funny chapter in the book.
It might well be, because the amount of four-star involvement in that thing was unbelievable. And
that went through just about everybody in the whole Navy Department.
Well, it went through a lot of people. Considering the controversy over it, it is the most staffed of any message that is.
Considering it had to be clarified five or six times thereafter, you mean? So that's why it took until.
But he has that.
Does this imply that this was something that he wanted to put out as quickly as possible, but it took from July to November to get it staffed?
Precisely. And that's in a staff that's working fairly fast. But the reason, I mean, doing things at a pretty fast clip.
How fast?
The reason it took so long is because of the length of time it took to get various people's concurrence on the thing, because we felt it was important to being the type of thing that it was.
Well, did you go through the fleet commanders, for example,
on
that one?
The commanders in chief.
Yeah.
Right. We got an input from everyone. This is all in a folder, which is available. I don't know whether Bobby has all those folders over there or not, but he asked for a lot of material before he left, and there is one over there that's got all the rewrites, and it's got a paper on top of it that I wrote for the record, which kind of enumerates all the staffing involved in that.
I think that would be a great thing to put in the book.
Well, I think he thinks so too, because I've told him that I've prepared such a thing. Matter of fact, he's got it.
And everybody wrote comments.
Yes, sir.
And this is all totally unclassified material.
Right? Yes, sir.
I suppose, however, some feelings would be hurt if their comments were.
Admiral Cousins, Admiral Clary, Admiral Holmes, Admiral Duncan, Admiral Went, and Admiral Hyland all were involved to some degree in
Duncan
that
has
kind of
retired life. To be one of my neighbors, fairly close to me.
Is that right?
Yeah, I met him a couple of times. A small little man.
Yeah. Do you want to go into the CNO days?
I like the way we're talking about it now, about the different Z-grams.
How long do you have?
I have as long as you've got cassettes, basically.
Yeah.
How long?